Welcome back to the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I'm Tom Costura.
And this is the weekly segment where we break down stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for November 4th, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, starting off this week, we have an article from Secure Annex. It's titled Sleepy Duck Malware Invades Cursor Through Open VSX. So a general summary here is Sleepy Duck is a malicious extension masquerading as a legitimate Solidity development tool. Solidity is a handle smart contract language, and it exists in the open VSX ecosystem. So the initial version of this that was actually pushed out on October 31st, just a few days back, was actually benign, but then there was a follow-up release the next day on November 1st that actually contained the remote access Trojan and the capabilities after obtaining enough downloads. So its persistence in C2 infrastructure uses a bit of an innovative technique. This is something I've been personally keeping a bit of an eye on because I think it's interesting. And it's leveraging the Ethereum blockchain via smart contract to store and rotate its C2 server address and fallback command retrieval logic, making it pretty hard to kind of take down. The actor targets developers of Solidity and smart contract code, and as such, you know, various crypto environment tools. And it does it by embedding this Trojan in an extension that appears to offer that language support. And the campaign reflects the increasing supply chain risk in extension ecosystems. This is something that's been coming up more and more often. I know that we've been talking about it for sure. Once installed, the malware collects host information, establishes a persistent loop to pull for commands, and can execute arbitrary commands remotely, giving that attacker foothold potentially inside developer machines. So, you know, kind of for defenders, really, we're looking at underscoring the risk of that developer tool chain compromise. And, you know, we're going to continue to talk about this more and more, but some of the technical details the article gives, which it doesn't go hard into the details itself, but I'll try to hit some of the top layers. So I talked about the various versioning switches in just a couple days. After that first initial switch to the malicious side, there were roughly 14,000 downloads. And then the next set of versions that were rolled out, you know, they've reported roughly 53,000 downloads in total, so which is, you know, there's a lot of volume there. But there's an interesting point to that I actually want to get to in a minute. But working down more of the technical pieces, the malicious logic triggers when opening the code editor window or when a .sol, which is a Solidity file, is selected. And then it creates a lock file so that it runs once per host, and it calls a fake webpack function in the JavaScript extension to masquerade itself as legitimate. Now, the interesting part, at least to me, is that C2 command infrastructure, because it first chooses the fastest Ethereum RPC provider, so the fastest remote RPC node it can connect to the Ethereum chain. It then connects to a smart contract, and that smart contract returns via a read the current C2 server address that's established. The malware then establishes an HTTP post communication to the domain. In this case, it's sleepyduck.xyz to exfiltrate data and pull for commands. And a polling loop runs every 30 seconds to check for those commands, which is kind of a giveaway, but we'll touch on that in a minute. If the domain is, or that C2 is taken down, it will then pivot and use fallback logic to connect to another smart contract. And it maintains a RPC providers list to kind of continue to fetch those new C2s. So it's really sticky. After the infection, the extension collects mostly what we're seeing here is it collects system information, you know, gathers hostname, username, address, MAC address, et cetera, time zones, and then sends all of that information in a post request out to that established C2. The malware does include some sandbox and evasion techniques, though in the article, it didn't really go into detail of what that means. So that's about the gist of what we know there. One of the things that was interesting and was pointed out is that the threat actor likely inflated the download numbers for these extensions to give it that appearance of legitimacy to kind of help lure more developers into pulling it down. the authors of the article did note that the extension marketplaces like OpenVSX and the official VS Code marketplace have been repeatedly used for malicious extension distributions. This is something, again, that we've talked about a ton, and it's going to continue. There is a little bit of a stat here that I think is interesting that was pointed out in this article, is that they show a breakout of 23 different legit Solidity extensions, just the Solidity extensions that have been compromised and used for malicious activity since just July of this year. So it's pretty prominent, definitely an attack vector. Something who we, you know, developers in particular need to certainly pay attention to. So some of the things that I kind of pointed out, Scott, here, or that I bulleted here to talk about when we're looking at how can we potentially look for or detect this kind of activity. Some of the giveaways here for me, and this may vary in depending on your environment, but one of the first ones I looked at was that that leveraging of those file events for those .sol files. You should know when you're leveraging these tool sets. It should be relevantly prominent if you are in a developer infrastructure. Beyond that, though, I would imagine these are pretty rare. You're not going to see them very often. Then you kind of have those blockchain RPC calls. So this is one that I think is between one of our last reports or more recent reports where we talked about the threat actor using Solana blockchain for C2. Now we're seeing the Ethereum blockchain being leveraged. You know, looking for those call outs from your environment, those RPC calls or connections to any of the various blockchain API tooling would be a dead giveaway. You're not going to want to see that, especially if you're not leveraging blockchain, which I would imagine the majority of businesses aren't really necessarily leveraging blockchain, or they should be managing, you know, their internal users leveraging it. You know, some of the other things that might be interesting to look at too, I thought maybe the process creations when you're looking at those extensions and what they might be doing. So identifying, you know, processes triggered by those IDE extensions, there might be something to search for, dig in on there. And then, you know, kind of like looking for that full scope correlation. So you see the IDE or an extension install with that RPC call, and then that outbound HTTP post to some random domain that's being there. Now that's a little more in depth and a little more correlation work, but definitely 1, 2, 3 steps to dig into this. So taking a breath, Scott, really the biggest reason I wanted to pull this one out is because I really do find it interesting that blockchain is being leveraged for C2 in these ways. It is a sticky little way of creating these C2 connections. And some of the stuff I've been kind of digging into myself, it's, you know, I can't imagine this is going to just be a one-off. I think this is going to continue and start to become kind of mainstay. So I'd be curious what you thought about this.
Yeah, you know, I remember last time we talked about the one using Solana or whatever the blockchain was. And it's kind of like, it seemed like I made the comment, it sounded like an enthusiast, you know, stitching certain tools together and being really creative with what they're doing. And then now we can see it happening again. So I do think that, you know, it will catch on to some degree. So I think it's worth taking the time and understanding how, I guess, applications or things communicate with blockchain. Because there are a list of like standard public RPC gateways or providers or relays for the different blockchains. And in this case, some of them are listed out even in the malware itself, so that when they were looking at it, right, they had the Ethereum public .block PI, they had the Llama RPC, which is, you know, ETH is the subdomain. So I'm guessing the Llama RPC as a domain, you can probably has different subdomains for the different blockchains that it tracks. So it might be worth taking note of what some of these things are, because, you know, you would not expect anything from your business networks to be leveraging this stuff unless it's something that you guys are involved in. And knowing when there's calls that are happening for that, sometimes just really easy to, once you know that's happening, go to a host, figure out what processes, depending on what kind of telemetry you have, are actually making those calls, those web calls. And you probably be able to find either infections like we're talking about here, or maybe something else trying to leverage something similar. If you don't just prove someone's just doing mining or something in general, or transactions with blockchain. But yeah, I think it's interesting how we're seeing it again. And I do think this helps us shine some light on how will we deal with the problem. I do like the execution piece, depending on what malicious components actually involved for fraudulent execution, but definitely looking for those RPC calls to those common domains. And that's something that, you know, if you log DNS, might be a really good source of data for this, or, you know, if not that, then looking for any kind of web proxy type stuff you might have. And I think in some cases, like, you know, from a sysmon perspective, you can specify those specific domains either for, I think they have a DNS event and they have a network event, but you might be able to just do some light logging, looking for things that you don't expect to log. And that would be a great way to catch telemetry that might be hard in a very dispersed environments or not centralized and don't, or maybe not have the right infrastructure in place or in front of to kind of capture all that. So yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. And you know, I would imagine from an attacker's perspective, leveraging the blockchain in this way makes it pretty cheap, easy, and helps with, you know, kind of masquerading and hiding themselves in a lot of different ways. It's easy to spin back up C2s. It's, you know, you can as you can see in this one, you just code in those fail safes and failovers, so your C2 just stays alive. So it's definitely move away from that traditional item. I'm imagining, and this is just my opinion, that this is going to become more of a mainstay, and it's going to be adopted by a lot more attackers from at least the C2 side. So yeah, thinking about it, getting ahead of it. Those sysmon events, I remember using those and leveraging those, Scott. I don't know how much you've dug into those, but they're pretty solid. I think it was like a VenID 21 or 22 for sysmon. But there's usually a lot of depth there, and that's a good log to go after if you're not necessarily collecting DNS. So it might be valuable, maybe even in a small scale, because it could be noisy in like your developer settings that might be the more prominent targets for this.
Yeah, I think it's good from a known attack perspective, or looking for like weird patterns that you may want to, you know, potentially capture, because, you know, those aren't the types of URLs you'd be going to or domains. I wish you could do more kind of granular stuff with that, but it's still great data.
Yeah. All right, Scott, what do you got next?
So the next one is an article from or blog from Arctic Wolf, and it's talking about the UNC6384 weaponizes the ZDI CAN 25373 vulnerability to deploy PlugX against Hungarian and Belgian diplomatic entities. And if I remember correctly, the UNC6384, is that Mustang Panda? I think they even called it out in here. Basically, they reported that around September to October of this year, there was an espionage campaign against those European diplomatic entities. There's a few, but most notably Hungary and Belgium. And they were showing that they're rapidly weaponizing the publicly disclosed Windows LNK vulnerability, which I think is interesting because, like, it's a vulnerability that has to do with white space padding. It's interesting that it's called a vulnerability when it's really just, since they're using an LNK in this instance, you can usually look at like the target file path, and people will put in like a PowerShell with the command line that follows, and that's how they execute things. But in this case, you can do white space padding before that. So if someone were to actually look at the LNK and look at that target file, it could be blank or things could be hidden and you won't be able to see it visibly from like a quick inspection. So it's just kind of a way to like kind of obfuscate. So it's interesting that those things are called vulnerabilities to me, but I guess I get it because it's something that is taking advantage of something that maybe shouldn't natively function that way. I don't know. But basically, they're able to execute obfuscated PowerShell from those malicious shortcut files. They'll later stage a payload. And what they're doing here is DLL sideloading, but they're using a Canon print utility, which loads the malicious DLL. And it's an encrypted PlugX payload executed in memory for the final payload. And the group used realistic diplomatic lures, that demonstrated fast dropper iterations. They relied on C2 domains infrastructures identified in that are in the report. And one of the things is Arctic Wolf did recommend disabling automatic link resolutions and then blocking some of the C2s and also looking for the Canon binaries in suspicious locations. But, you know, some of the big things that stood out to me first was they mentioned that the PowerShell, the encoded PowerShell, decoded and extracted a TAR file. That was like the first step it did. But it had to pull that down. So they didn't make mention of that, but I'm assuming PowerShell was used to then fetch the TAR and then pull it down, because when I was looking at some of the file size analysis stuff with LNK, it didn't seem like it was like, you know, padded or built in there unless I missed it. So they didn't have an exact example of that PowerShell download that I saw initially. But that's something that, you know, is pretty common, especially when PowerShell is being leveraged in these shortcut, malicious shortcut files. They usually will pull down a payload and then figure out how to run it. In this case, it's a TAR that it extracts. And in that TAR, it has the Canon printer assistant utility where it's able to leverage, you know, a real executable that's signed and not malicious, but is vulnerable to DLL side loading where they load in their malicious DLL. So the thing about the TAR, though, it's being downloaded to the app data local temp directory. And that's notable because, if I remember, one of the things after they go through this whole process, they get everything going, is for persistence, they also will use the current version run, registry key, right? And it's going to be referencing that Canon, utility at EXE. So you'll see already, you're getting that current version run, but you're also seeing basically that Canon utility running from the app data local temp, which is suspicious as well. And any executables written to the temp directory and DLLs could also be something to be paying attention to. Just knowing when those things are written is good to know. So that was some of the initial things to look for. They did have an alternate delivery that kind of walked through some of the life cycles that they've seen with this. And in some instances, they actually had an HTA file that was configured to run in the background, which would load JavaScript. It would load external JavaScript from a CloudFront URL, and that JavaScript was what facilitated the delivery mechanism to download basically the same things for the DLL side loading component. Which, in this case, you know, you would typically see MSHTA, right, launching W scripts. So you kind of have that script chaining that would have to happen. They didn't necessarily call that or show that, but that's something that, you know, as you start seeing how adversaries are using those lull bins and the things and ways to execute MSHTA, W script, PowerShell, command prompt, those are all kind of layered in together in many ways. So it's a good pattern to pay attention to. But the, you know, the PlugX, once it's in, it does have a lot of things it does to try not to get found based on how it uses internal APIs and tries to mask how it's going to call and use API functions based on hash values. It uses reflective code loading. It has some anti-analysis and evasion techniques, you know, checking for debugger, for instance. It dynamically loads system DLLs. And so it resolves our APIs at runtime. So it's harder for endpoint tools to scan the file for those patterns of the different APIs that you might see in malware. So, you know, it's always funny to me when there's all these like above and beyond to defeat the automatic detections with EDRs, but then it basically will get persistence by creating a current version run key in the registry, which is really common. That apparently, I guess, most tools that are looking for this don't key off of that as a signature. And I know that could be noisy because we've had people that will hunt for that and they'll see a lot of noise in general, but you know, that's tunable, right? Especially if you're managing your own hunts. But from a, you know, there, it looked like it was trying to capture a bunch of information. So, you know, when it comes from activity, as far as like, browser-based stuff, screenshots, all that kind of stuff was kind of common with this. And it was, I believe it was a rat as well. So it provided access as well. But yeah, it's kind of an interesting deployment. mechanisms using a lot of the same stuff we've seen in other kind of campaigns, especially on that initial delivery piece. That's usually the piece that I think is the best to detect is how something's going to land and then how it's going to execute. Because those don't change a lot, but the other following on stuff to stay present and not get analyzed by endpoint and protection tools, those are where things get a little different every time you look at these different malware strains. But yeah, what was your take when you kind of looked over some of the technical analysis of this?
You covered it pretty well. A couple of things that I like kind of picked up on just to try to fill in some of the things that, so I'm not repeating what you had said. I did notice like one, again, we've talked about this like in the past, but I'm going to bring it up again. So props to Arctic Wolf for the article. Love when they break out the MITRE tables in a way that actually give you the, you know, an evidence or example of what the thing they're talking about is, not just like, hey, it's this tactic and technique that's actually associated with the activity they're speaking of. I love that. More people should do that. Okay. Off that horse. Inside of that, as I'm looking through some of those tactics and techniques, you did see one that I thought was interesting, kind of low hanging fruit, where it talks about running some discovery file and directory discovery stuff, leveraging PowerShell get child commands and other file system enumeration stuff. This one's often overlooked, I think, because it's common stuff that's used, but when you see it away from that kind of admin role or a role that should be leveraging it, it should be pretty easy to identify, especially if you're logging those script block logging and you can kind of have better insight into the PowerShell stuff that's being executed. So that was one. Another one I thought about, and I think it's, I don't know, I didn't dive all the way in, but when it unpacks the link file, Scott, it had, I think, a couple files that were like with the .ta extension.
Yeah.
Which quick Googling said something about it being a Sony firmware file, but that had me thinking, and I'm just curious what your thoughts are. I always tend to start when I think about hunting or looking for weird things, just because of, mostly because of my experience, and this is the way I've done things in the past, but I love those kind of like broad hunts, you know, those very unstructured hunts, or looking at data, just like, you know, querying and pulling some stats on some of the data to see what anomalies might be there. Looking for the types of file extensions that are existing in your environment or being leveraged, accessed, open, moved, you know, whatever, might be a good poll, you know, because that when I see that .ta, I'm like, okay, I can think of some of the environments I've been in the past. I'm probably not going to see that, right? So you may find some oddities there. It had me thinking about that kind of unstructured approach to looking at some of your data to find some weird things that isn't necessarily fully defined yet.
Yeah, and it's funny you bring it up because that is the .ta is the actual tar file, but I'm almost certain they changed the extension name to avoid any of that detections where, hey, there's an archive file or something dropped in a weird location that people,
right,
you know, it's smart to look for. But, you know, just like you said, if someone changes something to not blend in or be the common, then it becomes an extreme outlier when you do those like unstructured, what does my environment look like when I look at just this component or piece of telemetry, and from like the most popular to the least popular, you find a lot of interesting stuff. You're right.
Yeah. And just the first two articles we talked about, you know, they're just some general, not commonly leveraged file extensions that we're seeing, like the .sol for the Solidity stuff, the .ta for this one, you know, that however it's being masqueraded, you know, it's like you might find some pretty cool stuff if you were able to just query what data you had to see what exists there and start a hunt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
Yeah. All right. What do you got for us next?
All right. Last from me this week, I have an article from Unit42 titled Microsoft WSUS Remote Code Execution. This is CVE 2025-59287 that's been actively exploited in the wild. So, you know, kind of short and sweet, Scott, but there are a couple quick hitters on this one that I had found myself that I think are valuable. You know, you're looking at a critical remote code execution that exists in that Windows Server Update Service or WSUS. The vulnerability allows authenticated attackers to execute arbitrary code at system privilege on affected servers. And Microsoft released an out-of-band patch back on October 14th of this year, which is the initial one, but they did have to do a follow-up emergency update on the 23rd because the first patch didn't completely fix the problem.
But this vulnerability is being actively exploited in the wild with public scanning detected shortly after the disclosure of this in pretty good numbers. And because those WSUS servers often kind of occupy that like central privileged role place, you know, thinking like patch distribution, domain trust, wide network reach, all that stuff. A compromise of that box can be pretty damning.
Yeah.
So some of the things that they talk about here when we're looking at the exploitability. So the vulnerability itself, the issue stems from an unsafe deserialization of untrusted data. So specifically, one path, an attacker can send a crafted request to the get cookie endpoint, which causes the server to misuse binary formatter on an authorization cookie object. And in another path, the attacker triggers reporting web servers and uses the SOAP formatter to exploit unsafe deserialization. So I don't entirely know what that means. I have a general gist on what I was researching. Maybe you can break that down better than I was able to. But the infected environments are basically any server with WSUS, Windows Server 2012 through 2025. It's not enabled by default typically. So the risk really just applies to where it was, you know, installed for purpose. But the public facing WSUS instances, especially listing on those default TCP ports of 8530, 8531, they're being actively scanned and targeted in abundance right now. And when the exploit that was explained, you're kind of seeing some pretty basic things that are being leveraged by this so far. So you'll see these kind of observed process change from that exploitation. So think of it, you'll see like the, you know, WSUS service kicking off a command, which then might kick off a PowerShell, or you might even see that IIS worker, so that W3WP service doing the similar thing. And then the initial payloads will run a bunch of discovery commands from what's been seen so far. You know, a lot of the who am I's, net user, IP config, all those things. They collect that data and then it's exfiltrated out, leveraging some typical PowerShell techniques like the invoke web request or curl to, you know, the attacker controlled infrastructure. Unit42 did report that 5,500 WSUS instances exposed to the internet were identified using their Cortex Expanse tool, which kind of gives you a bit of that scale for how much this is, you know, how much vulnerability is kind of out there. Mm-hmm. The big thing for me and the big takeaway for me is I thought this one was relatively easy to kind of look for it or hunt for it being exploited in your environment. So again, looking back to those process creation events where you see that that process, that the child processes of the WSUS service or that W3WP that like kind of are calling the command line, calling PowerShell, things like that. You also see those, the excessive calls for discovery. These are ones that we see a lot where people are just smashing, grabbing that kind of recon, looking for running those commands in succession. And then there is some network stuff that could be used, looking for, you know, communications inbound from those ports where you might not expect it. And then the obvious stuff is that PowerShell, you know, the invoke web request, the running curl. When you see that stuff that is unexpected, it's pretty low hanging fruit. I know you use that term a lot today already, but it still sticks. But yeah, really simple one, Scott. It's an interesting vulnerability. Definitely something you want to be aware of. There's still a lot that are unpatched because there's still a lot of, you know, demonstrated. There's a ton out there that's already open, publicly scannable. And the things that are accomplished when this is exploited seem to be pretty easy to track. So definitely, you know, consider, you know, either beyond patching, just consider looking for this stuff in your environment because it should be pretty easy and in most of your common logging. But what did you think, Scott?
Yeah, so this is what I like when I see exploits like this or this exploit activity, because I feel like you should already be looking for this activity in general. And so whether or not you're affected by this or know you have this or whatever, I would hope that if you're looking for this, you would see this. And then when this comes out, you would know this is why this occurred, right? Because maybe you're not the person who can say, oh, there's some zero day that was hit if you found this before this was public. But then you find that and then you realize something's hitting and you're trying to deal with this fight. And then this comes out and you're like, oh, well, this all makes sense, right? But yeah, that I talked about script interpreter chaining. We have command prompt. In this case, they even showed a command prompt, launching PowerShell, right? That's, and it seems like that's the double chain too. There seems like two command prompts in PowerShell as that chain goes. I don't know why sometimes the chain is always so big in that capacity, but same thing when we, anytime we see web servers or Windows web servers compromised, one of the most common things to see is W3WP kicking off either command prompt or PowerShell. So that's obvious. The reconnaissance is basic, nothing overbearing, but just running a few of those things, especially on a server when you don't expect to see those things even run, is a good one. And who am I running on a server, I think, is a little more interesting than who am I running on endpoint. I don't know why, but because I feel like when you log in a server, you know who you are.
You know who you are.
Yeah. Right. Like, so it's just like, okay, here's a critical thing, and someone's who's supposed to be there should know what they're doing. And then the invoke web request and curl, those two things being leveraged, especially on a web server specific or a server, can be very questionable. Like I said, sometimes it's good to narrow your scope, even when you look for these broad behaviors, by understanding the criticality or the function of like different areas, kind of break things up. So yeah, I liked how it is shows why we look for these behaviors, because regardless of how they attack, and they could be really impactful attacks or attacks that just kind of happen with just like, but not, you know, I wouldn't say benign malware, but like malware that's not very sophisticated or has a lot of impact, they kind of leverage a lot of the same things. So we should learn from those things and figure out how to apply them across the board. And I feel like this kind of captures a lot of that.
Yeah. Behavior. And yeah. I mean, like you mentioned it, W3WP and the WSUS service, everything I could find, because I'm not overwhelmingly familiar with it from like an admin level thinking, but it shouldn't be kicking off, you know, your command windows or PowerShell or any chaining of that sort. So dead giveaway.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right, Scott, what you got last for us this week?
Yeah, so this one's another Unit 42 Palo report. It's titled The New Windows-Based Malware Family, AirStock. And basically, AirStock is a new Windows malware family that abuses the VMware Workspace ONE or AirWatch MDM APIs. What's interesting here is it uses covert command and control and exfiltration channel by using either small messages from the device attributes, or if it does like a larger file, it uses the blob upload API that hits that AirWatch MDM. The two different variants of the malware is either a PowerShell or a .NET variant, and they're linked to potential supply chain style campaign that targets organizations and reaching downstream to victims. And what's interesting here is how they're, from my understanding, how they're able to even use AirWatch MDM is because they have compromised a credential or certificates that they're then able to leverage to authenticate when they interact with that API to then basically deploy the malware, use kind of parts of that service and kind of run downstream with it. So kind of an interesting approach, because it's, you know, something you expect to have open. It's not, you know, taking advantage of any kind of vulnerability. It's just kind of leveraging functionality after gaining access to something that enables them to do what they want to do. Basically, some of the backdoor capabilities, especially with the PowerShell variant, takes screenshots, gets the Chrome cookies, list files, list Chrome profiles, bookmarks, browser history, and then it can uninstall itself. So it looks like it really is just kind of grabbing information, especially from the browser specific stuff. I don't know if that's targeted that way because it's using the VMware AirWatch MDM type thing. So maybe it has something to do with most people that are working there. It's a virtual workstation anyways, and so they just work there and then they're off. So it's not something that they care about, persistent files locally. Not really sure, but you know, kind of an interesting approach. But the other thing to pay attention to is how some key things to look for. And one is when based on looking some of the code, when this tries to run, it actually tries to add a registry key to the policies in Google Chrome, because that's one of the browsers that kind of attacks, which is basically enabling remote debugging allowed. That's the key, right? So it's in the software policies, Google Chrome, remote debugging allowed, changes that to one. So it's true. That helps it get it the data. So paying attention to keys like that, any kind of debugging keys, especially if you find them in your registry, sometimes they're worth monitoring for future use cases. And then one of the calls they make from a persistence perspective is it looks like it's likely using a scheduled task, because in some of the code, it talks about for the uninstall portion, removing the scheduled task. And so, but based on the remove part of the code, you can tell that from the, especially the PowerShell variant, it is a PowerShell script or code block that is sitting in the C temp directory. So paying attention to scheduled tasks and some of the arguments associated with scheduled tasks, where you can see where, you know, what is it supposed to be run and where does it live? That's another key indication of something to pay attention to. And there is a lot of PowerShell things that we typically look for in the code blocks, but because they're in functions, I'm assuming it's already running. So I don't know if, and Tom, you may have experience with this. If there's like a PowerShell program kind of thing or something running, I don't know if the PowerShell logging picks it up in the transcript or not. If it did, it's great. You'd be able to see a lot of things, you know, they go for how things communicate with evoke web requests, creating WebSockets, all that kind of stuff you do from the web side of things with PowerShell. But if it's not picked up there, then the two other things I mentioned with looking for the registry key changes, as well as the scheduled task to kind of get notified something's going on and to pay attention to that. The .NET variants are a little, I would say, more stealthy, I guess, because there's not all the same traditional things, but it does have a lot of things built in for debugging as well. So if any kind of debugging is turned on as far as the malware goes, it does drop a lot of things in the ctemp directory. So you could pay attention to things that just get dropped in temp in general. In this case, they're dropping text documents. So you could pay attention to what kind of things are being dropped there. But I think they still also had the same similar persistence piece. So you could pay attention to the actual tasks as well. But yeah, I think those were kind of the key things to look at. Interesting way, right, to use the API of a tool that's there and use a certificate you may have previously compromised to leverage that. And then, you know, they do a pretty good job of running everything kind of in-house. So there's very, I would say, less artifacts, because a lot of that delivery and execution is happening from a non-traditional way, even though before I said that's usually the easiest way to catch things. In this case, since they're doing something so uniquely different, it's not something you would typically look for, but the other behaviors I mentioned as far as tasks and looking for certain registry keys, that's pretty consistent with how we address some of these problems. So yeah, what was your takeaway?
Yeah, I mean, going back to what you had mentioned in your thing, you can see the activity from a script if it's within the function through the script logging. So you'll definitely be able to pick up on some of these, which is good, because there's some common behaviors we see that we talk about regularly that can definitely be fines for this. You know, one of the things I thought is I haven't seen a get in, clean up, get out report, malware attack, you know, whatever you want to categorize it as, in quite a while, Scott. So I thought that was interesting. Just because it's we don't see it a lot, where it's really a get in, get what they need to get, and get out, and kind of hide itself, uninstall itself, remove itself, right? In certain cases here, which is interesting to me. But yeah, I mean, I don't want to necessarily go by and repeat a lot of what you had said. I mean, the invoke web request stuff, calls that we see, you know, the obscure things in your ctemp, the various, making sure that you have PowerShell login to try to identify a lot of what this is doing. I can't really add much to the .NET piece, but yeah, no, this is it's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I mean, like they even commented that some of the Chrome remote debugging, a lot of times Chrome's launched with flags versus changing things in the registry, because they did say that it's similar to like Luma and SteelC. But if I remember correctly, looking at execution from Lumen and StillSea, it actually launches Chrome with those flags versus this takes a slightly different approach by changing the registry key so it doesn't have to launch with those flags, which is they didn't necessarily call out, but I thought that was interesting. But, you know, that was something that was a little different than a lot of those dealers for the get in and get out stuff.
And I was curious if that's established, like the identifying that register key modification is established in most of the common tools to take away.
I'm assuming if you run with the flag, it doesn't change the registry. So now you gotta have to like look at two different places based on info stealers when it comes to the browser specific stuff. Well, I think that kind of wraps up what we were going to touch on this week. Quick mention, we do have our Guess Who edition Wednesday, November 19th. From 12 to 1:30 Eastern Standard Time. That's basically we're going to come to the table with an adversary we pick and all their TTPs and kind of run through them. And as we go through the behaviors and things associated with the adversary, people can submit guesses and try to figure out who it is before the big reveal at the end. So it's kind of a fun little change on things where you can learn about how an actor works for the lifetime of the actor. And maybe some of the things will be sticking points for you to identify who they are. So with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of November 4th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.